If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, you are listening once again, or you're being invited into, I should say, once again, to Life on Planet Porky. That is, of course, the podcast of myself, the Porkmeister, and Fleet Street rock chick extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie-Ann Jones, who's on the other end of the line. Leslie-Ann, fantastic to be keying in with you again. How have things been?
They've been mad, actually, Mike. You know, you can probably imagine I've been dashing around doing promo and publicity for my new book, Who Killed John Lennon? And so far, so good. You know, it does seem to be going down well, so I'm really grateful for that.
I think it's going to hit number one in the bestseller list. I'm delighted that, you know, I've been able to inspire you all the way through this project, as I'm sure you will accept, you know.
It's all down to you, Michael. It's, you know, absolutely every bit of it. You know, had you not been such a big Beatles fan, I'm sure I'd never have thought of it.
Well, you know, I can't possibly comment, can I, as they would play in House of Cards. But listen, one very interesting dialogue, which I saw you got involved in today, is that the title of your book changes depending on which continent it's on.
Yeah, it does. So all the various territories who acquire the book have their own markets, different types of covers, colours, typefaces, obviously words, all those things work differently according to the market. So the one that people have picked up on is the American edition, which is coming out in December.
Oh, yeah.
And it's in the States, it will be called The Search for John Lennon. And I think a few people have been thinking, well, is the title she's got here a bit salacious? But of course it isn't, because it's cryptic, as you know, because you've read the book. But they were very much of the opinion that Pegasus Books, who are publishing in the States, that they needed a different kind of a title and certainly a different cover.
Yeah, I saw the picture, but I didn't sort of focus in on it. Is it John Lennon lying on a piece of grass in Central Park? He looks too young to be Central Parkish.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. But
The same bit of Central Park, by the way, because I was there about 18 months ago. We did a show there. Is it the same piece of Central Park that was the closing scene of Wall Street with Michael Douglas when he confronted Charlie Sheen, who was wired up, and that's where he got done? Have you seen Wall Street, the film?
No, I haven't. Oh, but, I know Central Park, but not blade of grass by blade of grass. Yeah. I couldn't identify the patch.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose you do it by the skyline, don't you?
You do it around the park. You're absolutely right. Yeah, depending on whether you're looking west, east, south, or north. Yes, you're absolutely right. But in the Wall Street, for me, was one of the great films of the 80s. You know, it produced the villain Gordon Gekko and the famous quote, "Greed is good," you know. And I totally believe in that, by the way. I think greed is good. If we weren't all
greedy, you don't. No, stop doing yourself down.
No. If we weren't all greedy and seeking to achieve and obtain more, there wouldn't be a competitive element in life, would there? And then the whole economy would collapse. I mean, it's collapsing at the moment for other reasons, but if you see what I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with greed.
Well, I think there's a lot wrong with it, actually. Have you seen this latest story about Patrick Vallance, have you, having shares in the company that is supposed to be making the coronavirus vaccine? And he'd offloaded 5 million quid's worth of shares, but he just so happens to still have £600,000 worth. I mean, it's got to be a sackable offence. Surely to God. That would, if we were, as Fleet Street journalists, had shares in companies that we were writing about, I'm sure that our heads would have rolled.
Yeah, oh, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, it's utterly unbelievable that's happened. And these two pompous guys, I call them the doommongers of Downing Street, they walked up there the other night to deliver the latest bad news to Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who then decided to take their word rather than Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor's word, and all of a sudden we're plunged into darkness again, and it's all down to them. I think it's shocking. However, Miss Jones, I've got a much, much bigger problem just to tell you about before we go any further on this podcast, and that is that we're recording this podcast later in the day than we normally do. It's getting up to tea time, and I've had a mental dilemma on the way home. I can't decide whether to have bangers and mash for my dinner tonight or my famous Porky Parry fish finger pyramid. And you would probably tell me to take the pyramid because it's fish and all that, but I'm edging towards the meat dish.
So you've done your shopping then? You've got all the goods in?
Well, I had them all in before I went out this morning, so I knew I was going to have a tight day and all that. But my local butcher down here in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, he makes these fantastic sausages, so I think it's going to be bangers and mash, actually. But anyway.
It's quite nursery food, if you don't mind me saying. I mean, your tastes are quite simple.
Yes, people have accused me of that before.
I'm not accusing, I'm just remarking. Yeah. But you're not likely to make a paella, for example, or some sort of elaborate Italian pasta dish, no?
No. If I make any Italian dish, it will be spaghetti bolognese, which is I'm brilliant at doing. But I make spaghetti bolognese like creating a shepherd's pie on top of spaghetti. You see what I mean? Because I don't go for all this, like, you know, thin mince and all that kind of stuff. My mince is solid and all that kind of stuff.
But, there's a euphemism. What? My mince is solid. I'll take your word for it, baby.
Absolutely, yeah, you know. And then a can of tomatoes poured in on it and all that kind of stuff. You know, I love it and all that kind of stuff. But you see, what I'm totally against is going into restaurants and paying like 65 quid for a minuscule portion of food on a clear white plate, which keeps nobody happy, but other people do it because they think it's trendy to spend vast amounts of money on no food. I think that's ridiculous.
Well, have you ever done this, gone to a really smart restaurant and then gone home and had beans on toast?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
You know, because you go home hungry.
Yeah, I totally agree. So we're on the same wavelength there.
Yeah, we are.
Miss Jones, obviously we had a quick word about the Beatles because we always do, because you've written the best-selling book and all that kind of stuff. Getting back to our other favourite group, Queen, I see that John Deacon, a man we've spoken about before on this podcast, a man who's become more or less reclusive, but very wealthy, very decent guy, wanted to change the title of Bohemian Rhapsody because he said, and I have a lot of sympathy with this view here, the title was too long and the song itself at 6 minutes was too long, and he wanted to chop it down to 3.5 minutes and call it Mama. And I have to say, it was a very bold decision by somebody not to agree with him.
Well, we've talked about the fact that singles over 2.5 to 3 minutes long are generally not considered airplayable. Mm. But, you know, the odd one slips through every now and again. I don't think Mama is a decent title for a single, do you? I mean, this song is universally...
If you don't mind me reminding you, Miss Jones...
Well, yeah, but that was Mamma Mia. That's two words.
Yes, but what I'm saying is Mamma Mia would never have happened if the Bohemian Rhapsody had been called Mamma, because I bet you ABBA wouldn't have possibly then called their record Mamma Mia, because Queen's would have been a massive, huge worldwide hit.
Actually, they were chasing each other around the charts, those two records at that time, yeah. But Bohemian Rhapsody is so unusual, isn't it? So loaded with suspense and intrigue. And I don't think you could have called it anything else, really. The fact that it's universally known as Bo Rap kind of, you know, gives in to our inclination to want to abbreviate things, doesn't it?
Sure. No, I totally agree. In the end, of course, they are massively successful, so who can argue with that? Now, Miss Jones, you know, I keep an eye on all the books that have come out. Yours, of course, is heading to number one. But a lady called Julie Welch has had a book published called The Fleet Street Girls, The Women Who Broke Down the Doors of the Gentlemen's Club. Now, we've talked a bit in the past about, you know, Elvinos and But this book's brilliant because there's one bit in it where she talks about the disgraceful behaviour of male journalists in Fleet Street. And she illustrates a story here, which I have to totally disagree with. Everybody smoked in those days, OK?
Yeah, I didn't.
No, exactly. And I didn't either. And most of the people around the news desk were men, and they used to smoke their cigarettes while staring at the copy that was coming in and taking telephone calls, and then they would flick a cigarette into a bin. She says on more than one occasion she's seen men reacting to a bin going on fire by literally having to urinate on it to put the fire out.
Disgusting. Imagine if a woman did that, sat down on the bin and sort of peed all over the flaming bin.
But I'm sorry, I totally object. I've never seen that. You know, I've been in Fleet Street, as you have, at the sharp end, at the coalface, in the worst possible buildings. I was the last news editor to news edit the Daily Express in the Black Lubyanka in Fleet Street. It was a shocking building. There was no air conditioning. It was falling to pieces, but it was beautifully, you know, fantastically Fleet Street and all that. I never saw that sort of thing happening, and I think Ms. Welsh has actually over-egged the pie there.
I think, yeah, it does sound a bit made up. I never saw anything like that. Yeah. I saw some things, as did you, you know, both in and out of the office. But, yeah, I've even seen sort of sexual things going on in the...
In the toilets, according to...
In the old dark days, yeah, a bit of that. But, no, I never saw a man urinate on a waste paper bin.
I mean, if it had happened and I was in charge, I'd have sacked him anyway. I think it's happened.
Yeah, of course. It is disgusting.
Absolutely disgusting.
Yeah. But I did know a bit about Julie Welch because
she was
a contemporary of my father's. She was the first female football reporter.
She was. That's
which she was made in 1973, so long before my day. But she came to our house, actually, for a couple of parties.
Did she work for The Observer?
The Sunday Telegraph.
Sunday Telegraph, right. Okay, yeah. Go on.
And she famously wrote those glory, glory days about her childhood obsession with football. Mm-hmm. And she also co-wrote, I think, The Ghost of White Hart Lane with Rob White relatively recently in 2011, yeah.
Wow, that would have included tales about your uncle, Cliff.
Yeah. Although, yeah, a very fantastically clean-living uncle I do have.
Mm. That's amazing. No, I don't know too much about it, but, I mean, if that's the case, she definitely broke through a glass ceiling. So she came to your house. Was that for one of your famous Sunday lunches with...
No, this was my mum and... Mum and dad used to have lots of parties in those days. They were big party animals.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd have the sort of England 66 World Cup squad and we'd have Terry Venables and Alf Ramsey, all those kind of people.
Yeah.
At the parties in the good old days.
Absolutely fantastic. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Miss Jones, but Twiggy is 71 this week. And I have to say that... It kind of passed me by in the 60s. I was too young. I was born in 54, so when Twiggy was emerging into, like, worldwide stardom, I suppose I was about 12, you know, in sort of 65 or 66 or something like that. Nevertheless, she became a huge star, but she hasn't actually done anything for about 50 years, has she?
Oh, I think that's unfair. Let me tell you, in 1983, I was in New York with her because she was appearing on Broadway in... A show called My One and Only.
With Tommy Tune?
I don't know if it was Tommy Tune. My memory doesn't stretch that far back. Yeah. My One and Only. It was a show built around Gershwin tunes.
That's right.
And a sort of slapstick love story.
I was working in New York at the time. I was stationed there with the Daily Express, right? Part of my two-year detachment to New York. And I'm sure the guy she starred with was Tommy Tune. And I'm sure he was about 6 foot eight. And she was about, honestly, I'm not joking, like 5 foot one or something like that. I'm pretty sure it was Tommy Tune.
She's about my height. Yeah, she's really lovely. And, of course, we share a name. She's actually Dame Leslie Lawson.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, because her husband is Lee Lawson. You know, he was the baddie in Tessa the D'Urbervilles. Do you remember that film?
Yes, that's right. I absolutely do. But my great story about Twiggy is not about her current husband or her second husband, Lee Lawson. It's about her first husband, right? Whose name I can't remember, actually.
Oh, Justin de Villeneuve.
No.
Not him. Oh, they weren't married, were they?
No, they weren't married. No, it was some guy she married in... He was an American. And honestly, this is shocking preparation for our podcast that I did look the guy's name up, but it's gone right out of my head. I've got a bit of a sieve head, you know, this time of day, particularly with this lovely glass of Sancerre.
I was going to say, how many bottles have we had so far?
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah. But no, seriously, what happened was, we were all in Costello's, which I'm sure you visited a million times. You know, and Costello's is on, I think, 46th Street, right?
It's gone now. It's closed.
It has gone. Yeah, I know. Yeah, sadly. Funny enough, when I was last in New York 18 months ago, we did a show there. It had reopened, but it wasn't anything like it was, you know, decades ago. Anyway, the point of the story is we're all in there. There's no mobile phones in those days, but there was a phone box inside Costello's. And if anybody from London wanted to get a hold of any of their people, they knew to ring the phone box in Costello's. And then Freddie the barman answer it, yeah, okay, hey, Parry, it's for you. Or Conyo, it's for you, you know, or George Gordon here, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And the phone rang, and I think the first one, I think it was Conyo, actually. I think it was the mirror. You know, hey, Conyo, it's for you. And Paul took it. What? My God. And put the phone down and then ran out to the pub, right? Phone rang again. George Gordon here. Yeah, yeah. Third one, Philip Finn. Phil was the guy who worked with me for the Express. Anyway, what happened is that Twiggy's husband, who was the father of her child, had collapsed and died of a heart attack in the McDonald's restaurant six blocks down. So,
are you sure about that? Because the exact same thing happened to Joan Collins's husband.
No, I'm absolutely certain about this.
How extraordinary that they both have the same experience.
What, in the same location?
Well, I'm not sure it was the same McDonald's, but Joan Collins's husband, Ron Cass, who used to work at Apple. Yeah, he took the little girl, whose name I can't remember, out for a McDonald's and died over the McDonald's at the table.
That's amazing. Well, it's a very similar story because, as I say, we're in 46. This McDonald's was on 36, so it's 10 blocks south, okay? And as you know, Manhattan like goes downhill as you go from north to south, fortunately. So as soon as I saw Phil run out the door, obviously I said, I'm coming with you. We ran down there. Anyway, literally, the guy had collapsed and died in a McDonald's restaurant. All the ambulances were there and all that kind of stuff. You know, poor child was sitting there crying. He actually died. He just died of a heart attack like that. Anyway.
So it begs a question. Who informed the newspapers at that point? And how did they know who he was?
Well, everybody knew he was a famous actor. He wasn't just Twiggy's husband, right? He was a famous actor. But he was a famous actor who'd fallen on hard times, you see what I mean? And it was all drifting away from him while Twiggy's career was going up. And I think that's why she left him, to be honest. Or I'm not saying that she purposely left him, but I mean, their careers moving apart and all that kind of stuff. I'll find out the guy's name.
I think, are we thinking of Michael Whitney?
Yes, that's it. Michael Whitney.
Okay.
Michael
so he died in 1983. That's about right. I was there in 1983. Yes, so
exactly.
Yeah, that all adds up. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Go on then. I'll give you that.
Absolutely. Thank you. So, excuse me. So anyway, all that happened. And then 2 weeks later, they were going to, his funeral happened. They were going to bury him. We're going to bury him in a place north of New York City in New York State. And it was in the winter. And the problem is, as you well know, that New York in the winter is so cold that
you're not going to get a spade in the ground.
Absolutely right. So what happened was that his hometown was somewhere in North New York State. And we all drove up there and it was freezing cold. It was about like minus 10 or something like that, you know. So all they do is they have the service. And then they have to store the body in a mausoleum, which self-freezes because it's so cold until March. And then they actually have the, you know, the consecration and all that kind of stuff, you know. But anyway, the point of my story is, because I know I'm boring you to death now.
Okay, you're getting off the beaten track here.
I am, yeah. So I went up there with Martin Dunn and we've told... Dunn of the Sun, absolutely right. And we've told our listeners before that Martin started off as, you know, the Sun correspondent in New York, ended up as a international editor on both sides of the Atlantic, terrifically successful and all that. But in those days, Martin and I were simply, you know, working reporters in our early 20s, trying to make our way through the national newspapers and had been both been posted to New York, which was a great opportunity. So Martin and I drive up there, and, you know, very efficient. We got there about 5 hours early. And then we realised there was nothing much to do. So we thought, come on, we're going to have a lunch, as you do when you're a Fleet Street correspondent. And we drove about, I would say, 5 miles, found this beautiful sort of old, you know, travel lodge and all that, and got stuck into a bit of lunch, a few drinks.
Oh, no. Anyway, I can hear what's coming.
Right, we come out, right, we're still with 2 hours to go until the service, and we hadn't noticed that a blizzard had happened. I'm not joking. We hadn't noticed that there were 6 inches of snow on the ground. It was unbelievable. It came just like that. When we walked into the place, it was very cold, but it was a pale blue sky. When we came out, it was a blizzard. And do you know, we only just about got back. The journey to the lodge had taken about 25 minutes from when we first got there. It took nearly 2 hours to get back. The car was, you know, scraping on the snow and sliding all over the place. It was horrendous. And we only just made it back. And when we did, the thing lasted 5 minutes, and then we were stranded there for 2 days with a blizzard. So anyway,
there are worse places to get stuck.
Yes, I suppose so. But that's
poor old Michael Whitney, huh?
Poor old Michael Whitney just went down just like that, yeah. Now, Miss Jones, I'm not accusing you of anything, but I've seen a survey recently which says that women of around about your generation are really on the prowl, and the number of what we might call cougars, that's lady of your generation, seeking younger men, is going up and up. And it's a good job you don't live in Manchester, because apparently cougar women in Manchester are really getting stuck in. Do you have any experience of this phenomenon, Miss Jones?
Well, how very dare you? Certainly not.
Well, I've got to ask the question, would you?
I think you can't call all women between the ages of 30 and 59 cougars, because we're not all out on the prowl, Michael.
Right.
Some of us have got better things to do.
Really? You're like, what? What have you got better to do then?
Well, I've got work, I've got my kids, I've got my mum, I've got my friends.
Yes, okay.
You know, all of that.
No time for a bit of socialising in between.
Well, I've kind of done my share.
Might involve, you know.
Yeah, I know. It would take a hell of a man now to. No. It would take a hell of a man to disrupt the life I have. For,
really?
You know, Yeah.
Okay, well, we should...
I did my bit, you know, I served my country in that regard,
yes.
But...
Okay, yes, I'm
sort of pleasing myself now. But if Superman comes along...
Yes.
All singing, all dancing with everything going for him, who's to say that my head won't be turned?
Well, there you go. You could be absolutely right. Now, the biggest cougar town in the country is Manchester, 67%. Women aged between 30 and 59... who pull toy boys. I mean, I can't really believe it.
Oh, it's gross, isn't it? I mean, they're young enough to be their sons.
Yeah, it says
they
in
Manchester. They want to pull their knickers up and behave.
Well, you know, this is a family show.
Family show.
But it says the city in this country where young men don't particularly want to get involved with women who are older than cougars is Coventry, where only 29% of young men would consider cohabiting or consorting with an older woman. I think that says quite a lot about Coventry, really.
Well, isn't that where you get sent if you persona non grata, traditionally? Yeah, sure. I'm not exactly sure I'd go for the men of Coventry either.
No, well, I'm sure you're absolutely right.
No offence to the men of Coventry.
No offence to the men of Coventry at all. We can't let a podcast go by without referring to the fact that John Lennon's killer, and obviously we've talked about the book already, has apologised to Yoko Ono for what he described now as a despicable act. Will that change anything?
Oh, what do you think? I mean, I think that, look, he's had another appeal for parole turned down, and I think he's finally got the point, you know, that he ain't coming out, right? So he is now switching his agenda, and he's admitting that he killed John very much because he was seeking personal glory.
Yeah.
And he says that he is very sorry for the pain he caused Yoko, and that he thinks about it all of the time. Sorry doesn't make a bit of difference.
No, I
John's still dead. This guy is staying inside. And I think for everybody's sake, he ought to remain there.
What I think's amazing is that he said, well, I did it because I wanted my moment of glory. You know, John Lennon was the most famous man in the world, which he was. and I wanted my own glory. I mean, crikey, I've made some mistakes in my life, but, you know, and I've regretted them. You know, I've regretted sometimes walking out of a job and on a point of principle, although I've never, ever regretted the principle that I walked out of the job on. Do you see what I mean? But, you know, yeah. I could have just bit my tongue and, oh, no, come on, don't get so principled about it. You know, just stay. And I haven't. And I've regretted it. But, I mean, to do what he did, you know, never mind the Lennon thing, to just do something so stupidly on one evening when you decided you want to be the most famous man in the world, which he was for about 3 days, wasn't he, with all the newspaper headlines and all that kind of stuff. But then you spend the rest of your life, pal, in a sort of concrete bunker. I mean, what a stupid thing to have done anyway, no matter who the victim was.
Well, he does get to go into his caravan with his wife for the conjugal rights and the pizza for 44 days a year, I think, or something ridiculous. But look, I mean, I try not to think about him, and I know that Yoko won't have his name spoken within her earshot.
Yeah, well, I don't blame her.
And Paul Gambaccini, the same, when I was interviewing him for my book. We don't say his name because we don't want to give him credibility. No. So I think he can just rot away quietly. I'm sure that Yoko's forgiven him because the only way that we can grow...
How could you?
Well, because you don't want to carry around bitterness in your heart, do you? Because that only eats away at you. Mm. So you have to forgive these hideous misdemeanors in order to grow as a person. You have to.
Maybe. Okay.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for being with us today. You are, of course, listening to Planet Porky. I am the Porkmeister, and delighted to say alongside me today, although only metaphorically, because, of course, we are social distancing after the government have imposed a load of new rules on us, is Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. I have to say, Leslie Ann, I'm bloody angry about the turn that the government have now taken. We need an economy in this country to be able to maintain our great society, and they have completely and utterly let us down, in my view.
I do agree with that. But on the other hand, you know, an economy depends on people. And if all
people
die...
depends on, society. And society depends on people getting going, not sitting at home all the time.
Yeah, but if all the people die, then an economy doesn't exist, does it? So you've got to find a balance. The statistic that really worried me yesterday was that the fastest growing group of people falling ill and also dying from coronavirus are young women aged 20 to 40.
That's shocking, but I bet it's...
And I looked into that. It's primarily because they're on the front line. They're having contact with many, many different people because of the kind of jobs they do. No. It's nothing to do with socialising. Right. It's to do with the fact of the jobs they do. So lots of them are, for example, nurses or doctors or working in retail or in hairdressing salons or all those kind of things where they're exposed to lots of different strangers as opposed to only a few.
Yeah, but it's a tiny percentage of people who are now involved in what's going on. 0.01% of people in this country are either carrying the disease, threatened by the disease, or might die of the disease. And nobody under 45 has died of it anyway. I think it's a pathetic overreaction. And Boris Johnson...
I don't think that's true, by the way. I think people have died of it under the age of 45.
Very, very rare. And if it's happened, it's happened because they've had underlying health conditions, honestly. I've done a lot of research on this. Boris Johnson came to us as the Prime Minister with an 80-seat majority as the optimist, not the pessimist, you know, the man who's going to lift the country, the man who's going to take us forward. He now looks like a shell of a man. I wonder whether he's still completely knackered by the fact that he had COVID-19, or I wonder whether we've all misjudged him because he's a great campaigner. You and I have seen these people over the decades. Great talker, great campaigner, get in there. And then when you're asked, right, now do the fucking job, excuse my
language. Family show.
Family show, I agree, but we're at extremes here. Is he up to the job?
Well, he looks very fat to me. And maybe he's not over the disease. It has crossed my mind, because he does sort of, his eyes kind of half close when he's sitting there in the house. And he looks a bit sleepy. His partner has gone off on holiday without him, staying in a £600 a night hotel on Lake Como with her girlfriends. You know, I don't think that's really the right thing to be doing at this point in time, is it?
Well,
but I don't know. I mean, it's, God, I would not want to be doing their jobs right now, all I can say.
Well, I think somebody who wants to take it on should. I, you know, I don't see a lot of films in the cinemas these days, and I don't watch a lot on telly. But, and there's been loads of films about Churchill over the years. But the one that really hit me was The Darkest Hour. Do you remember the film I'm talking about? You're not a great film star, are you?
I see a few films. That's not the... Gary Oldman. Yes, of course I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was quite fictitious. There were lots of moments in that film that didn't really happen, such as when Winston Churchill got out of his limousine and went down onto the tube.
Yeah.
Of course, he never did that, you know, to solicit opinions from the common man or woman. That didn't happen. And once I find out something like that, I lose faith in a film.
Well, look, you know, you and I should be the last to actually criticise dramatic interpretation to enhance the message. You know what I mean? We've done a lot of that ourselves all our lives. I'm not...
What are you saying, that you made stuff up?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I was going to say, Leslie, I'd never accuse you of making anything up. You don't have to.
Well, absolutely not.
No, exactly. You never have done. You've had so many facts that you've done. But what I'm saying is you can emphasise parts of a story and de-emphasise others for, you know, to get the message over and that kind of stuff, you know, and that's happened all, you know, ever since newspapers were published. But what I'm saying is that we think now that we're in terrible times and Boris Johnson wakes up in the morning and I'm in the middle of a dreadful catastrophe, I'm in charge. Churchill woke up, and this is what I love about the, you know, The Darkest Hour, to be told that President Roosevelt was no longer going to bankroll Great Britain. No, I'm sorry, Winston, we can't give you any more money. We can't send you any more planes. We can't send you any more ships. I mean, crikey, at that moment, we were dead. And yet Churchill got through it without, as you quite rightly say, you know, slopping around the Commons looking like a beaten man. And I think Johnson needs to, you know, shake his head and have a look at it.
He does look a bit beaten. What did you make of Keir Starmer's address to the nation?
Well, I don't understand why it happened, because...
It's not an election campaign, is it? Why is he doing
exactly.
it?
Exactly. You know, the Prime Minister comes on and gives a statement to the nation about a national crisis. So you're quite right. And the next evening, BBC decide, oh, we'd better give Keir Starmer his go as well. Why? That's never happened before. And it's another example of, in my view, completely skewed and wrong thinking within the BBC. They're supposed to be impartial. But anyway, look, this is not a political show. I want to ask you about Mylene Klass, Leslie-Ann, because in my mind, Mylene Klass is almost the perfect woman. There's nothing she can't do. She's a classical musician. She got into that pop group that got to number one, what they called, All Stars or something, right?
Hearsay.
What was it called?
Hearsay,
that's right, yeah. She can stand under a shower in Australia and look like the world's most beautiful woman, you know. She has brought up children. She has, you know, conducted things on television. I mean, she's a bit of a superwoman, isn't she?
Well, she conducts things on television, or does she present them, do you think?
Well, whatever she does, she gets on television. She's only 42, and I'm reading a Precy here.
But all the things you've just read out or told me, all the skills, let's say, so standing under a shower, I can do that. Bringing up children, I can do that. Presenting on television, I can do that. Is she really Superwoman? I'm not sure I see where this is going, Michael.
She's a radio DJ as well, got her own show and all that. I mean, I think you're being a bit unkind here.
Well, are you saying you fancy her?
I'm not bringing, you know, personal...
oh, yes, you are. Look, I think she's talented. She's all right. She doesn't really turn me on. She's not really... Look, she's not my cup of tea.
Not your cup of tea. Well, that surprises me, because in all the time we've done these podcasts, when you've had one good thing to say about a woman, you know, vaguely in our business who's actually got on with it,
That's very unfair, because I'm always championing the cause of women. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a nice little factoid about Mylene Klass.
Right.
You know the Christmas song, Cliff Richard's Mistletoe and Wine?
Mistletoe and Wine.
That's the one, yeah. Children singing. There's a choir in the background. Yeah. And Miley in class, age 10, is one of them.
No, you're joking.
Yep, serious.
that is fantastic, isn't it? Now, I need to tell you something else, Miss Jones, because you won't believe these things, but you, of course, are a bit of a snowflake when it comes to electric cars and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
He's so rude, isn't he? God, well, a snowflake. Well, okay. Goodness sake.
Yeah, let me read this to you. Electric cars only go eco after 50,000 miles.
Wow.
Electric cars need to cover up to 50,000 miles before their environmental impact is less than a traditional car, a study has revealed. So what do you say to that?
Well, most people don't keep their cars beyond 50,000 miles, do they?
No.
So what's the point of an electric car?
Well, what they're saying is the electric car doesn't do anything for the economy until you've driven it 50,000 miles.
Or even the environment, you mean?
What did I say?
Economy,
darling. Oh, yeah, sorry. Well, the economy and the environment, actually.
But, have another glass.
Yes, I think I will. Problem is, my housekeeper's gone home, so I've got nobody to pour.
Oh, so you have to pour it yourself. It's tough at the top, isn't it?
yes, it is. But no, what I was going to say is that actually, I've never kept a car in recent history. What would that be? 20 years. That's gone over, I suppose, 14 or 15,000 miles. Because I don't buy cars, I lease them. Do you see what I mean? And you have a 2-year lease and all that, and 10,000 a year or something like that, and whatever. I wouldn't buy a car because the minute you drive it out the showroom, this is a long, well-known statistic, the car loses a third of its value, doesn't it? And all that kind of stuff.
I thought it was more than that. I thought it was more like half.
I
do own my current car, but it's only got about 30,000 miles on the clock, and I've had it 5 years.
That's very good. In fact, you're absolutely right. I might now decide to buy a car because I don't use a car a lot. I work in London. I live in Guildford and down on the coast. I need the car to get to the coast and back. I don't need it to get from Surrey into London. So you're absolutely right. What I might do now is I might budget myself to buying a car for £25,000, okay, which would be something like a sort of secondhand Mercedes E-Class or something. You see what I mean? And then just park it in my garage and use it when I want. Because if you lease a good car, a decent car, and I always had a top-of-the-range car, it's about £800 a month, and you have to put down about £5,000 on the first initial payment. And what a waste of money that would be if the car's only doing what I do these days, about 3,000 or 4,000 miles a year. You know what I mean?
There's a lot of people in this country right now living on an awful lot less than £800 a month.
Yes, that's right. And to spend it on a car which is basically parked and doesn't go anywhere, I think you're absolutely right.
It's kind of immoral, isn't it? Really?
It is kind of immoral. I totally agree. I mean, look, I love to have a beautiful, shining, I mean, literally,
a beautiful, shining car. Fill in the dots. Yeah. Oh, a car. Sorry. Yeah.
Listen, Miss Jones, stop taking us down the smutty roads with the in the back of your brain.
You can talk. God's sake.
And I'm talking about a beautiful car. You know, men have a
car. Yeah, yeah. I'm with you.
Didn't Diana once get up? Didn't Prince Charles get upset once when Diana sat on the bonnet of Prince Charles Aston Martin? Do you remember?
No.
Oh, yeah. But,
I mean, the sight of the Prince of Wales driving an Aston Martin anyway, it's a bit incongruous, isn't it? It's an oxymoron. It doesn't match.
It was, literally.
It'll never make him good looking.
Well, it'll never make him James Bond, will it?
No.
No, literally, it was one of the great polo events at Cirencester or something like that, you know, or Windsor Great Park or something. And she came along to support him. I think she was still his fiancée rather than Diana, Princess of Wales. And she literally sat on the, you know, like the wing of his car above the right wheel or something like that. And, you know, a furious Prince Charles came rushing across the, you've got off his horse, rushing on the park, get off my car, you know, which was horrible, really, and humiliating. But I mean, that's why I think people feel about the cars. But now,
well, you know, if I'd have been her, I would have run a mile at that point, because I would have known that he cared more for his motor than me.
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely true. I think you're absolutely right. But no, it's lovely to see the car. You see, I've got an underground car park, and it's, you know, safe and protected and all that kind of stuff. So I, sometimes if I haven't driven the car for a while, I just go down just to have a look at it, because it's just a beautiful piece of engineering, beautiful machine, you know what I mean?
Does it have a name?
No, I don't call it a name or anything like that. But
you don't talk to it?
No, of course I don't talk to it. But it's got leather seats, and leather seats smell beautiful and all that kind of stuff. It's a beautiful part of my life, which I don't use enough, you see what I mean? So I may give up.
Which could be applied to all manner of aspects of your life, Mike.
Oh, what's that? Sorry.
Yeah, change the subject.
Yes, I don't either. But I'm not going to pursue it. Now, I want to ask you, please, because you seem to know everybody in the music business, about a man called Mitch Murray, okay?
Oh, lovely Mitch. Right. Yes, I do know Mitch very well.
Because he's apparently a big friend of Don Black, and you've told him before that Don Black's a big friend of yours. Is that right?
Yes, and Don is equally gorgeous, yeah.
Right.
Mitch actually invited me. I accompanied him to a music publishing Christmas party at Brown's Hotel in December.
What, that we just got?
Yeah.
When we were still a free country, yeah?
Yes, yeah. And in fact, his daughters, Maz and Gina, are very good friends of mine, and Gina read for my book on David Bowie, Hero. She is the voice of the audiobook of that book.
Really?
But yeah, they're supremely talented girls. They're big West End stars.
Yeah.
So Maz was in We Will Rock You, and she has been in Mamma Mia and Chicago. And I think Gina was playing Donna in Mamma Mia. And massive stars, very talented family.
Okay.
Mitch himself wrote songs like The Ballad of Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh.
How do you do it for Jerry and the Pacemakers? Do you remember that song I did, What I Did for Maria? Who did that one?
Oh, that was Tony, what's his name? What was his name?
Tony Curtis, was it?
Yeah, no, not Tony Curtis. He was the actor, wasn't he?
Tony somebody.
But no, the best part of this story, and I don't know why everything we talk about leads back to the Beatles. I suppose that's the huge influence they've had on my life and yours. But Mitch takes this song. In those days, apparently, Abbey Road Studios weren't called Abbey Road Studios. They were called EMI Studios. They just happened to be on Abbey Road. And they only became Abbey Road Studios after the Beatles, you know, album, Abbey Road. But anyway, sorry, the point of the story is the Beatles go down to London and George Martin's there, and they're asked to perform this song called How Do You Do What You Do To Me? I Wish I Knew. And they deliberately, this is the tale I've read, looking at this man's history, deliberately played it off key and out of beat and all kinds of stuff to make it sound crap, because they wanted to play their own song called Love, Love Me Do, which was their first hit. Do you have any info on that, Miss Jones?
Well, if in fact, Mitch did tell me the same story when we were discussing my book. Yeah, it is a true story. So it was going to go to the Beatles, How Do You Do It? I never understood the title, How Do You Do It? Because that's not what it sounds like when it's sung.
No, it's not, no.
It always annoys me when the song title kind of varies the lyrics, but that's just me.
Yeah.
But he's a really lovely guy, and he's very funny. He's quite short, and I always get the impression that he has become a funny guy. He made a massive career sort of latterly after songwriting, writing jokes for people, for speeches and that kind of thing. And he's published quite a number of books on the art of speech writing and telling jokes. Yeah.
Fantastic. You're absolutely right. He wrote that song which Tony did. But do you know one of the great songs he did write? And I was astonished when I read through this list. And by the way, Mitch is not dead or anything like that. It's not an obituary. What happened was...
No, he's only 80.
He's only 80. But our old colleague, Richard Littlejohn, wrote a column in tribute to his 80th birthday. And Richard, who I've known literally since my days on the Birmingham Mail, Richard was the industrial correspondent on the Birmingham Mail, right, when I was a reporter. And we used to have such great times. You know, you'd go out after work, and Richard's just a great guy, you know, and all that. But he wrote this column. He'd known Mitch for years. I don't know where he...
Well, I'll tell you how, because Mitch founded a society called SODS,
right.
The Society of Distinguished Songwriters.
Right.
And they have a ladies' night every December, which I also attend at
right.
the Savoy.
Right.
And Richard Littlejohn is always part of that. They
oh,
go wow. back years. Yeah.
Right.
So John Blake always comes along as
oh, brilliant.
As one of the guests there as well. Yeah,
yeah, brilliant. But anyway, so it is. But the one song which I was absolutely astonished to find out that Mitch wrote was... My Delilah. Delilah. I saw the door and she laughed no more. You know, and all that kind of stuff.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. But I didn't realise he wrote Tom Jones's, you know, one of Tom Jones's biggest hits, Delilah. Isn't that crazy?
I've got a feeling Barry Mason had a hand in that song, but I might have remembered that wrongly.
Well, mate,
I'll have to look it up after.
Well, Rich claims it, that Rich claims that Mitch wrote it. So there we are. Listen, just before we go, I just wanted to mention another... person who's had a birthday this week, and that's Mark Phillips, Foggy.
Oh, God, now, Fog,
yeah. We've spoken about Foggy before, you know, thick and wet. That's why they called him Foggy. It was in the art.
Yeah.
But did I get round to boring you to death about the story about his illegitimate child in Australia?
Yeah, we have touched on that before, because that's when his marriage to the Princess Royal cracked up, wasn't it? When she found out about it.
Yes. Do you think that all the stories about Princess Anne liking a lot of physical activity with her royal bodyguards was true or not?
What, you've actually heard that?
I heard much more than that. That
really?
Yes.
She doesn't look like a shagger, does she, Princess Anne?
This sounds very unkind, but sometimes you're, you know, grateful for where you can get it, if you show it.
No. When she was young, she was really beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
So she was 70 recently, and there were quite a lot of spreads, I use the term advisedly, photographs of her when she was much younger.
Yeah.
And she was a beauty. She really was.
Yeah.
So I don't think those people were being grateful for what they could get, and neither was she,
right.
by the way. But I'd never heard that she was a shagger, but maybe I was just a bit too young to have...
I think she was. I think that's quite well known, you know, in one of the most amazing stories that I've ever come across in political world is, do you remember a guy who was the Home Secretary for Labour? What was his name? He was a very down-to-earth man who'd been a postman. But he rose up through the union ranks and very, very nice guy. And I can't even remember his name now. But he was the Home Secretary, so I should remember his name, you know. But...
What, did he have a go?
No, he and his wife got divorced because his wife started shagging the detective who was Mr. Johnson's, that's his name now, funny enough, private protection officer. So the guy I'm talking about is the Home Secretary, right, under Gordon Brown, okay? And I wish I could remember his name. I can see his face in my head.
It's one of those days, Mike, isn't
it? Yes, it's one of those days, I'm afraid, yeah. And he has, they all have a personal protection officer, okay, who travels with them all the time. I mean, literally sits next to them in the car, sits on the table next to them in a restaurant and all this kind of stuff. So old Mr. Johnson, not Boris Johnson, obviously, is going about his business. And suddenly finds out that whilst he's been, you know, on trips to America and all that kind of stuff, his personal protection officer has been having sex with his wife. And obviously that led to a breakup of their marriage, as I suppose it would, yeah?
That kind of thing has got to happen such a lot, hasn't it?
It's got to, you know.
Because it's the nearest thing, isn't it? I've got a friend, actually, in the village where I live.
Yeah.
And her husband is a right-hand man to a head of state, not of this nation, obviously.
Sorry.
And she was found having sex with his bodyguard on the bonnet of his car up at the golf club.
Yeah.
And how she got sacked, i.e. here are the divorce papers, was when 10-8s, black and white 10-8s of this activity were thrown in front of her on the kitchen table.
Good God, I'm not sure.
Yeah. So I think it's you know, it's a fairly obvious move, isn't it? Oh, he's near, he'll do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not for me, thanks.
Well, there you go. Talking about, this is the last thing now on the end of this Planet Porky podcast.
What, have you had enough of me now?
No, I haven't had enough of you, but I've got a closing story. I once had sex with a woman on the bonnet of my sister's car at my sister's house in the garage during a Christmas celebration party when the said woman's husband was still sitting round the table in the dining room.
What?
Having Christmas dinner.
What? You did that?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Michael, God's sake, what an absolutely disgraceful admission.
This woman had fancied me for ages. She was a neighbour of my sister's, you know, and she'd always been giving me the eye and all that kind of stuff. And it was, honestly, it was Christmas Day lunch and all that kind of stuff. The table for about 16 or something.
So she had her stuffing.
Yeah, she had her stuffing. That's a bit hard. And you know, she winked at me as she went out into the kitchen. And then beyond the kitchen is the door into the garage. And yes, we consummated the relationship, I'm afraid, during Christmas.
Relationship? You've barely even spoken to the woman. I mean, family show is all I can say.
Yes, that's right. And it was a BMW, by the way.
Well, at least it wasn't an Aston Martin. And at least Prince Charles wasn't sitting in the driver's seat.
Absolutely, yeah. Right, okay, Miss Jones. Well, I think we better call it a day there.
On that note.
Isn't it, you know. But anyway, listen, well done. Thank you very much. I can only say that the more I see and hear about your book, the better it gets, and I'm sure it's going to be a worldwide success, as is Planet Porky. Ms. Jones, until next time.
Until next time.
Cougar women in Manchester are really getting stuck in. Do you have any experience of this phenomenon, Ms. Jones?
How very dare you? Certainly not.
Well, I've got to ask the question, would you?
I think you can't call all women between the ages of 30 and 59 cougars, because we're not all out on the prowl, Michael.
Right.
Some of us have got better things to do.
Really? You're like, what? What have you got better to do then? I once had sex with a woman on the bonnet of my sister's car at my sister's house in the garage during a Christmas celebration party when the said woman's husband was still sitting round the table in the dining room.
What?
Having Christmas dinner.
What? You did that?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Michael, God's sake, what an absolutely disgraceful admission.
This woman had fancied me for ages. She was a neighbour of my sister's, you know, and she'd always been giving me the eye and all that kind of stuff. And it was, honestly, it was Christmas Day lunch and all that kind of stuff. The table for about 16 or something.
So she had her stuffing.
Yeah, she had her stuffing. That's a bit hard. And you know, she winked at me as she went out into the kitchen. And then beyond the kitchen is the door into the garage. And yes, we consummated the relationship, I'm afraid, during Christmas.
Relationship? You've barely even spoken to the woman.
Listen, Miss Brown, stop taking us down the smutty roads with the back of your brain.
You can talk, God's sake.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.